Herzlich willkommen zum Modelleinsatz, der mathematische Podcast aus Karlsruhe mit Gudrun Täter und Sebastian Ritterbusch.
So, today I have the pleasure to have a guest in my office again, a guest from India, and I will try to pronounce his name. So I welcome Debashuti Chaudhuri.
Chaudhuri, yeah.
Yes, well. And the interesting thing for me, of course, it's always interesting to talk to guests and to have a broad horizon also of my own research. But when going through the titles of your papers, yeah, there are quite a few things which would also be in the titles of my papers.
I see. Okay.
So like Stokes or Prandtl and Laplacian, things
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes.
And also the kind of abstracts with weak solutions and regularity and interesting boundary values.
Correct, yeah.
And then each time when I try to understand more what you did, I'm like, oh. This is like a completely new world to me. So this will be interesting for me to get an idea of your point of view of things we share,
yeah,
but have a slightly different point of view.
Right.
Yeah. And I was proposing that we take as an entry point to our discussion a small note you published on the archive about fractional Laplace operators. And maybe my first questions concerning this paper is, why did you take the time to write that down and think this through?
Yeah, so firstly, thanks for this this podcast which you have invited me, and thanks for the kind words. Secondly, to answer your question on these lines, so this was done about 5 or 6 years back, probably around the COVID period when everything was closed. And I also had questions to my own understanding of the subject, during which I went through several videos, several books, several monographs, several manuscripts to understand what S. Laplacian or the fractional Laplacian is all about. That is when I thought that it's not just me, there might be many people who might be having the same questions of really knowing or really having some kind of interest towards distinguishing between the usual Laplacian and the fractional Laplacian. And then I thought that let's put it in this way. Let me just draft all the things which I have learned in the process, which will be helpful to the community to understand the fundamentals of the subject. Because as you can see that usually the Dirichlet boundary condition when you involve a Laplacian is quite different from the fractional Laplacian. In Dirichlet, it's sufficient for you to just specify it on the boundary. Whereas for the fractional, you need it in the complement of the domain. So these are certain aspects which I felt that it's not just me. There are probably many people around who needs a proper understanding of the subject. And rightly so, I do get queries on this article from people to understand the nuances of the fractional Laplacian. Mm. And they do have certain genuine doubts. And in the process, I have also made corrections in this manuscript based on the queries which people have put up. I never thought of publishing it. It was just meant for purely academic purpose. Mm. And that is how it took place.
Yeah. And for this, of course, the archive is a nice place. You can just put it there and you can even, if you have a change, it's easy to just change it. And people also see the different versions, what's changed in between. And so a discussion about why do you come to this outcome, either you're right or the other person is right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you can see that, yeah.
Yeah.
The funny thing for me is, one of the funny things,
yeah,
is that of course, a person not working in our field could ask itself, but of course there are textbooks, things like that, But I know, of course, that it's just helpful up to a certain point.
Yeah.
Because, for example, for fractional Laplace, and there are like, I don't know, maybe a dozen different definitions.
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, a few of them are really absolutely equivalent, obviously, but a lot definitions need a lot of work to understand that in a way you enter the same topic just from a different entry point.
Yes.
And then reading your article, of course, gives you one way just to enter it, just to have a certain first point, which is helpful. And then to look around from this point of view and then to have a red line through what the questions are you ask in this short article.
Correct.
Yeah. So you decided to define the fractional Laplacian with the help of the singular integral.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is this related to the fact that this is a way you work with the traditional Laplacian as well?
Yes, yes. It is related to that. Where usually we give the definition of a harmonic function in terms of an integral using the mean value.
The usual is always kind of,
Yeah, so it's just the replication of the same idea into this. As you rightly said, there is no unification of these definitions. But the closest one that relates to the usual Laplacian is the one which you are mentioning about, the S Laplacian using the principal value of a singular integral. Yes, and it also, the surprising part, not so surprising part, but the beauty of the definition is that as your S, the order of the fractional derivative, converges to 1, your S Laplacian converges to the usual Laplacian.
Yeah, and this makes all mathematicians very happy.
Very happy.
Yes. No, because it's just nice.
Yes.
And then you feel that the definition is just the right one because you can consider that to be a generalization of the things which you know already.
Correct.
Yeah. Of course, when I'm talking with my students about, very often about modeling, that's a starting point to discuss the Laplacian. Then I'm always telling them this is just a representative of all diffusive processes.
Yeah.
So very often we enter this through changes in the temperature, things like that, or just having a drop in the middle of water, and then this just distributes itself by, for example, Brownian motion.
Yeah.
And then a lot of processes work like that, that you don't really have powers of a force that forces the process, it's just the small movements. And then the mathematical theory around that tries to work with some physical understanding of that, but also with very abstract concepts.
Absolutely, yes. And people have not stopped here. People have...
not yet, yes, I'm sure.
People have further generalized it to the P fractional Laplacian, with P being a function of X, of course, a nice convex function of X, S also being a function of X, and it's just moving on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, so with the Laplacian, also when I'm discussing with engineers, they have the feeling that this is somehow related to the real world, so to say, so what they can understand. But if I'm going over to powers of the Laplacian and fractional powers in the derivatives, what are things which I model in the real world which need this complicated operator?
Yeah, so the simplest application of the fractional Laplacian is the one which has been given by the probabilists, where imagine having a finite domain, bounded domain, and there is a fly, which in search of food tries to enter this domain. So what is the probability or the expectation of a fly to lie at a certain point inside the domain? The expectation is what gives you the fractional Laplacian, gives rise to the notion of fractional Laplacian. So this whole thing stems out of what is called as the random walks in the language of probabilists. So it's not the diffusion, but it's more of a probabilistic definition which comes into play when talking about the fractional Laplacians. So this is usually the example which is given to somebody who is trying to find a foot on this topic.
Yes, and do you know other examples where it turned out it makes sense to use it because we already studied it mathematically?
Unfortunately, I'm not into the modeling part.
No,
so,
no, no.
Yeah, I definitely would have loved to give you some, but yeah, so maybe because I have seen people using the fractional derivatives in general, not just the Laplacian, on dimension n equal to 1, that is the dimension 1. But I have not seen even the people involved in modeling, to the best of my knowledge, I have not seen people even working it in the two-dimensional planes.
Mm.
It could probably be because of the lack of mathematical tools. It could probably be because there are many things which is still not understood in the nature and is still not related to this particular idea of fractional thing.
Mm.
But yeah, everything is on a one-dimensional a space.
So it's very, in this way, it's in the spatial domain, it's very simplified if it's just one-dimensional.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, so maybe it makes also sense to come from the place, if you work with the Laplacian, then this general framework I was hinting to is that we do not really try to solve the Laplacian, even in an analytical sense, with paper and pencil, I'm saying to my students, or just mathematical methods. But in 100 years ago, there was the idea that it's easier to make this with functional analytical methods and to put one of the derivatives. So the Laplacian needs second order derivatives in all spatial dimensions.
Yeah.
And to put one of the two derivatives on a function which is already very smooth.
Yeah.
And so it is able to take any number of derivatives.
Yeah.
And so we just share the derivatives evenly. So fair. One derivative onto our solution we are looking for. Then the second derivative goes to the so-called test function. And then we integrate over this and have an infinite number of equations we're trying to solve all at the same moment. And this sounds crazy, but it's easier because we have tools for that.
So incidentally, there's one very nice result. So if you take a smooth function, locally everything looks like a fractional Laplacian.
Mm.
It's a very powerful result. And there are many agreements with the Laplacian as well. Like for instance, if you have a function which is S-harmonic, let me put this as the word, S-harmonic, and it's zero in a small region, then it has to be zero everywhere. So these results are quite analogous to what we have in the Laplacian case.
So just for the poor listener to our conversation, harmonic refers to the fact that you apply the Laplacian and the result is zero. And so S-harmonic means it fulfills the equation Laplacian within the sense of S-Laplacian is equal to zero. It's just a different way to speak about solutions to the system.
Yeah, two languages.
No, it's fine. Hmm. And the harmonic always sounds like music, but this is because the music is composed out of functions which solve the Laplace equation. With zero. With this fair distribution of the two derivatives, I wanted to go to this fractional derivatives. Because, for example, in the Navier-Stokes system, in which I am working a lot, even if I'm mostly working on the steady part, but there is also the part where you have just one time derivative of the velocity field.
Mm.
And if you want to make something like that, that you have this one derivative and you want to share this fair with some test function, then you have to have one half of a derivative and one half. And this is the point where it really makes sense either to come up with something completely different or to have this all fractional possibilities, fractional derivatives.
Right. So just to continue the thread from where you left. So usually when we multiply a test function to a fractional operator, So you, what we do in the Laplacian case is we just distribute it amongst the gradients.
Yeah. And it's so nice.
It's beautiful.
It just all breaks down when you have fractional powers. Yeah.
Yes. But the moment you have fractional thing of order S, let's say, you distribute S by 2 order derivative to each of them.
Yeah.
So the S by 2th order of each of these derivatives plays the role of gradient here in the fractional case. Yeah. And it's an established proof. It's not something which is heuristic.
So especially, for example, just to compare this as well, in the Laplacian, you would always try to have the estimates for the gradient, for example, in L2, which would it's just a very nice space.
Correct.
And also lends itself to a very general class of possible right-hand sides.
Yeah.
And if you have the fractional gradient, so to say, then you have to bound this.
Yeah, it's also estimated in terms of L2 norms.
And so in the Laplacian world, we always need estimates, however you call this, in the W12 space or H1, as it's very often called if you don't leave the L2 for other ways. So for example, in the Navier-Stokes world, we still have this open millennium problem.
Yeah.
And there's always one way people try out to come up with new results, not to take the Laplacian, to say with order 2, like in the L2 space setting, but to work with a Laplacian to in the LP sense.
Yeah.
And then to have P bigger than 2.
Yeah, and
because then you get
making
results.
It smaller.
And then only in the limiting process, then everything breaks down.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sharp breakdown.
Yeah. Up to now. We still have hope that someone has a new idea. But this is also a way to go away from that Laplacian, because it's just one point where you cannot get what you would like with some certain non-linearities side by side, because the Laplacian is kind of the only force in the Navier-Stokes equation which can regularize things, and the nonlinear irregularizes it. And they have to have a certain balance. And then the question is, if we make the Laplacian slightly more powerful, and the answer is yes, just a little bit more powerful is enough to have certain results.
Yeah. But isn't it so that when you work with P Laplacian, there is a loss of regularity because of that? Yeah.
You have to pay.
You have to pay the price, of getting a solution,
And then, of course, it's also the case that the P Laplacian is also a good model for certain crystallizing processes.
I see. Okay.
Because they often have a symmetry which is not with 2, but for example with 6 or 12 or things like that.
Okay.
And then this occurs naturally also in its own merit to have a P Laplacian with some certain P, which is the right one for the process.
Correct, yeah.
And also we have this in image processing, because there also we try to have, like, if there is some nonsense on the picture, just some blur or things like that, then you want to make a diffusive process which kind of takes away the blur.
Yeah.
And then you also have to find, to say, the right Laplacian.
Yeah, of course.
The Laplacian itself, of course, is the first try.
Yeah.
But then very often, if it's just a special type of blur, then you also use Laplacian with certain powers.
Correct. Yeah. So pretty much many applications of these Laplacians other than the usual ones.
Yeah. You already hinted to the fact that there are certain problems with the boundary conditions, or it's interesting with the boundary conditions that you can always look at it as you like. So in the Laplacian context, it's very often really necessary to work with zero boundary conditions in order to have the spaces fit to each other.
Yeah.
Also because we take the one derivative on the other side, and then we have a boundary integral, which we would have to take care for, but we try to make the zero.
Right.
Just to have an easy way of going through all the derivatives and estimates.
Yeah.
And if we have different boundary conditions, very often we just establish some extension of this boundary value as one solution, and then solve the solution with zero Dirichlet boundary condition, and then we put everything together back.
Yeah.
Yes. So with the fractional, what is where does this come from, that the treatment of the boundary has to be completely different?
Well, firstly, the fractional Laplacian is considered over the entire domain, the entire plane.
Full space.
Yeah. because it's a non-local operator.
Yeah, okay.
So you have a disturbance far away from where you're living, it still affects your value of the fractional operator. So if the value is only specified on the boundary of the domain, the problem becomes ill-posed. In the sense, so if I divide, suppose you're inside a domain, let's say omega, and then I divide the entire space as omega and the complement of omega. So if I now study, if I pick an x which is inside the domain, okay, which is inside the domain omega, and I try to compute what is the fractional Laplacian of u at the point x, where x comes from the domain. So I can, outside the domain, I can put as whatever value of u as I like to. Okay, it could be g, it could be h, or it could be anything. So these changes will have a huge effect on the value of the fractional Laplacian of u at x without even changing the point x. So it becomes an ill-posed problem. It becomes just an ill-posed problem if we just specify the value of the function on the boundary.
Hmm.
So we need to specify it just outside, including the boundary and outside it, so that there's no more further changes, the changes cannot be eccentric in nature. So you're not free to change about outside. The moment you're given that freedom, the value of the fractional Laplacian also changes by a huge margin without even moving from your point where you are. So this is the reason why we need to specify the boundary condition, not just on the boundary, but in the complement of the domain. Yeah.
Yes. In your paper, you also present a nice trick, which was published at the beginning of the 2000s by Serin and a co-worker, mm-hmm. whose name I just don't remember just now because I didn't write it down. Would you be able to just give a general idea
of which particular
idea? To extend.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll give you a very heuristic idea which the people connect to.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the definition of fractional Laplacian is more closer when we understand it via the Fourier transforms.
Yeah.
So whatever I have cited there, see, whatever we do for half order derivative, it's sufficient to understand the entire thing. So that is why I have chosen 1/2 as my order of derivative. So just look at the partial derivative of a function with respect to x, y, or whatever variable you want to, and then you apply the Fourier transform to it. The Fourier transform of that thing will be same as the Fourier transform of the half order Laplacian. So this actually gives you a connection between the fractional Laplacian and the usual derivatives. Okay, that's the whole point. So what is usually done is we add a variable to the existing space. Let's say you're in the n-dimensional space. I just add another variable, say y, and I write down the Laplacian in terms of these variables, but in the dimension n plus 1 minus s. Okay, we raise it by 1 and then reduce by the fractional order. And then after you get the Laplacian, it's the usual thing. You apply the Fourier transform, you get an ordinary differential equation, you solve it, and then you reapply the Fourier inverse to retrieve back what will it be in the higher order, higher dimension. Yeah, so that's the whole idea in short, in a nutshell.
Yeah, and of course this is only easier because we understand what Fourier transformation and inverse Fourier transformation do.
Yes.
And if we are able to go in the Fourier transformed space, things with respect to derivatives become easier on this so-called phase space.
Yes.
So
everything reduces to a polynomial kind of thing. Yeah.
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 And we think that we can solve all the polynomials.
Yeah. Yeah. At least we think.
Yeah. 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 People doing this, doing PDEs, that's just trivial stuff. And then, of course, going back sometimes it's hard. But if you are in a space or in a model where other people already worked, then it's clear how to come back. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then you can, because this is kind of a standard way to work with partial differential equations, you can also use it in order to understand this fractional powers better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in which sense do you work with this concept of fractional Laplacian in, let's say, in the latest years? What are the kind of steps you take after you understand this or that you can apply it?
Yeah, the natural idea will be to see the existing results on Laplacian. Mm-hmm. Does it work for the fractional Laplacian or not? So the natural questions are existence, uniqueness, multiplicity, and regularity.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to see or mimic the proofs of the problems that involves Laplacians and to see if the results of fractional Laplacian augurs well with these results or not. So that's the usual natural progression, which not only me, many in my community, in my research community, has taken the plunge into. Yeah. So yeah, that's a natural progression towards the...
So, and a few of your papers are about certain types of nonlinearity. Is there also this kind of trying to balance this type of nonlinearity with the right type of Laplacian?
No. Because the nonlinearities do not have a huge impact on the problem, but it's an operator that that plays the key role in controlling the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the nonlinearities are the usual ones. You have the power nonlinearities. The difficult ones are the one which has critical exponents, the Sobolev critical exponents, because it's not just in the non-fractional case, it's also in the fractional case that the critical Sobolev exponents leads to the loss of compactness. Then you have measure data problems, where the right-hand side is a Radon measure. Instead of having a function, you consider a Radon measure. You can even have the exponential nonlinearities, which is of a specific kind that these nonlinearities have been mostly considered by two people. Let me recall the name, Moser and Trudinger. Yeah, the classic ones. Yeah. And then you have the logarithmic nonlinearities. Yeah.
I'm laughing because these are also the ones which we cite when we are doing Navier-Stokes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's this Gilbert-Trudinger framework and then the Moser technique of filling
boundedness.
Holes. Yes,
To prove the boundedness of a solution. Yeah. The bootstrapping argument.
Yes, the bootstrapping, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, of course, in a way, this is also in the mathematical context a field of research where you have to learn a lot of things before you can do something new.
Right.
So how was your way, firstly maybe to decide to become a mathematician, and then when starting to take this route, ending, so to say, nowadays, it's of course not the end of your work.
Yeah,
just today we meet at some point in your life where you do this and do this with fun.
Yeah.
So how is the story behind that?
Yeah, so... right after I finished my schooling, I had the option of taking up two of the subjects which I liked back then, which still I like, that is physics and mathematics. But then, as you know, our country, we are financially a poor country, and my family could not afford me to get into a physics course because the prices of enrolling in a physics course were higher because of the practical experimental
stuff,
tools
yeah.
that we need to get into. So mathematics was the natural go-to subject. And that is when I began understanding mathematics rather than, instead of just solving it, I began understanding what mathematics is all about. Got in touch with the epsilon delta language of mathematics, which is what helped me to have a greater affinity towards analysis than algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Then after finishing my master's, I got into a PhD program. And my PhD program was into solving and analyzing the Stokes equations.
Yeah.
Stokes equations, but
Yeah, first I was thinking we start with Stokes because this is my field, but then I was like, no, I don't see how I can present this in a way that we can even start to discuss something after I prescribed what you did there.
Yeah. So, but I also had to do a bit of numerics there, which I'm pathetically poor in. So that is when I came across this book, which was, of course, suggested by one of my doctoral committee members by Elsie Evans, the book on PDs. And that is when I thought that, well, this is something which I'm directly connecting to. And in parallel to what I was doing in my PhD, I also began a rigorous course on partial differential equations, the functional analytic type, the Sobolev spaces, and things pertaining to that. Attended several workshops to strengthen my understanding. And then after getting a PhD degree, I thought that enough of Stokes equations. I need to now make a shift of getting into the analysis of PDEs. And that is when I actually began undertaking problems and not just reading books and passing my time. So when I actually undertook problems, I saw that the field has already taken off long back, and it's going to be a lot of work before I actually get hold of the current trends of research. It took me about 3 to 4 years to fall in place. And then I had my first publication in this field around 2016, I believe. So from the year 2012 to 2016, I was void of any publications because I was spending time in the literature surveys, studying what kind of problems is accepted in the community. Even knowing what are the good journals in the field, and not just that. So it was from 2016 that I first published my work. And then I had a student with whom I got the opportunity to discuss a lot, from whom even I learned from him a lot. And that is when the whole research thing kicked off in my life. And with time, I changed many things in between as well. In this analysis of PD, I began with existence problems. Then I got into the variable exponent problems, the fractional thing which we discussed a while back. And now I am into the abstract critical point theorems, which are really difficult to work with. So this is the journey in a nutshell. Yeah.
I'm astonished that you were reliant on having enough time that you can spend just a few years without publishing anything. Of course, this is as it should be, but it doesn't really happen nowadays very often.
Yes, I was fortunate because that was firstly 14 years back when the theory of publish or perish wasn't into existence. You can still sit without a publication. Of course, without promotions, but you do get your salaries on time. So I saw that as an opportunity. Okay, let's first strengthen the foot. After that, the publications will follow. But yeah, it worked. I'm fortunate that it just worked. It could have gone the other way as well, but luckily it worked for me. Yeah.
So in Germany, very often, if you are working in this field, you are coming from certain universities where the PDE research is really strong.
Yeah.
And there they really kind of streamline the educations of the students in a way that have a bit of an advantage compared to you.
Yeah.
So they already in their master's program, they have like PDE 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
Even sometimes.
Yeah.
So for example, in Bonn, this happens. And so they have seen a few things already. And then, of course, they are working with people who know where their research is just at the moment and can give them one or two letters up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just putting them... and then, of course, it's also hard because nevertheless, even if they know where a point is where they could start their research, they nevertheless have to sit down like you did.
Correct.
And read and understand and make the methods their own.
Correct.
And this takes a bit of time. Of course, they have good partners to discuss things with, which also helps.
Yeah.
But I still consider this one of the hardest parts in mathematics to come up to a point where you can do something new.
Correct, yes.
Yeah. The funny thing is, of course, people will think that taking an operator, it's already abstract enough. So, for example, the Laplace operator. But then we take the fractional Laplace operator, which sounds really stupid to people not being mathematicians.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you know what I did for my PhD thesis? I just have to leave that here. Because I didn't treat the Laplacian, but the Stokes operator.
I see.
Because I'm a fluid person.
Yeah.
And so it's just taking the Laplacian and solving it for fields which have divergence-free property in addition.
Correct.
And of course, then you have certain properties, how this projection works. And in one way, it's easy, and coming back, it's not so easy. Yeah. And you need smoothness of boundaries and things like that and bounded domains. But then working with the Stokes operator, I took it to imaginary powers.
I see.
So
okay.
Purely imaginary powers.
Okay.
And of course, this has no physical background at all.
Yeah.
But it was a possibility to add two operators in an abstract way.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to solve a problem in an infinite cylinder.
Yeah.
And so I was solving the Stokes problem in the cross section.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could add the operator, which gives me just the infinite cylinder axis.
Yeah.
And if I can bound the imaginary powers, this was what was hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But this is kind of funny. So mathematicians come up with all kinds of abstract
crazy
stuff.
Crazy ideas,
And they still tell you that it makes a lot of sense.
In fact, just to take you through the current research arena in elliptic PDEs especially, people have now began working on abstract non-commutative groups, especially the Heisenberg groups, or more generally the stratified Lie groups, where usually when you add two vectors, you commute, but when you have these Heisenberg group operator, the commutativity is lost. So the PDEs are now studied on these abstract groups. And people have begun using, including me, people have begun using techniques in from algebraic topology, where they try to figure out the cohomological group at each critical point of the energy functionals associated with the problem. And they look at what will be the order of the group, and that will decide the multiplicity of the solution.
Yeah.
So things are, what I feel is that PDE is such a topic which is actually bridging the entire mathematical community.
Yes, nowadays more than ever, yes.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So you already work quite a few, have been working quite a few years at the university you are working just now. So how is your situation? Are there many students taking mathematical courses? What do you teach there? Can you invite people, if people listen to us, to India to become a student of yours maybe?
Ah.
So at KIT we always invite people to come to us, of course.
Thank you, So prior to working in this institute, I worked in a different institute earlier, which was called as the National Institute of Technology.
Mm-hmm.
We have two brands of institute in the country. One is the National Institute of Technology, and the other is the Indian Institute of Technology. And they are present in...
It's kind of funny from the outside, sorry that I'm laughing.
Yeah.
Because, of course,
they
the nationality
the
is Indian, and as a mathematician,
they
it sounds
the
like the same, yes.
Yeah. So each of these brands are present in each province in the country.
Mm.
So every province of India has got one IIT and one NIT, as they call it in short.
Mm.
So I was in an NIT previously. It's if I put it in a hierarchy, the IITs rank higher than the NITs, if not on paper, but at least in perception. So I was in an NIT, so where I spent about a decade teaching there and carrying out research. Life was difficult in the sense because besides this, the administrative load was quite heavy, extremely heavy, and we did not have any kind of personal secretary to assist us. So it was the faculty who was the clerk, the signing authority to the office bearer, to everything. But things changed as times progressed, recruitments took place, and the administrative load got less burdened than it used to be previously. I used to teach both the masters and the UG students.
Undergraduates.
Undergraduates and undergrads, yeah.
Yeah, this would be bachelor students. Mm.
Yes, the same thing there, yeah. Mm. So they're mostly, the UG is comprised of the engineering students and the integrated master students. That is, they have the option of finishing their bachelor's and master's altogether in a span of 5 years. So the UG students were a challenge to handle in the sense purely because of the number of students that were present in the class. I began with 110 students in a class, and by the time I left after a decade, it was 160 in the class.
Mm.
So handling 160 students is really a challenge, and catering to everyone's needs, maintaining the attendance and the assignment sheets, of course, the usual mid-semester and the end-semester examinations, that comes as a challenge. I really enjoy teaching the master's students because the subjects are more closer to me, closer to my mathematical understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I mostly taught mostly all the branches of analysis, namely real, complex, functional, measure theory, differentiable manifolds, variational analysis, of course. Yeah, so these are the subjects which I have taught. Of course, not to forget ODs and PDs. Yeah, so these are the primary subjects which I have taught there. And then I shifted to the current institute where I have been working for about 3 years now. I have taught partial differential equations, variational analysis, and functional analysis.
So this is all on the master's level?
All on the master's level. Mm-hmm. And I did have the opportunity to teach the undergrads for a semester in this institute as well. But they were relatively easier to handle because the strength was quite lower than my previous institute. Yeah.
Yeah. And so do students mostly come from the same province or?
No, it's a centrally funded institute. So they come from almost every nook and corner of the country. Yeah. Yes. So the entire strength of my current institution is like you have 5,000 odd students, and the mathematics comprises of, let's say, around 60.
Mm-hmm.
In the entire master's, 30 plus 30. And then you have the PhD students who are around 50 in the department. So we are a community of 120, let's say. Yeah.
Yeah, so you know almost everybody, at least the ones which are more near to your topic.
Yeah, definitely, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe that's a good point to end our conversation.
Sure. Thanks.
Thank you for visiting me and taking the time to explain your area of expertise to me.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for inviting.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.